You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WCKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KWMD Kosilov Anchorage, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton-Vealton, or WMRW Warren.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride.
I also believe we're going to succeed. I believe we'll prevail. Not only do I know how important it is to prevail, I believe we will prevail. I understand how hard it is to prevail. But I also want the American people to understand.
Take the bright silver.
One way to assure failure is just to quit.
Taken from somebody else.
This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week on the program, we heard how the emerging class of 19th century industrialists and their political and intellectual allies reimagine prosperity in terms of coal-fired mass production culture, how they set out to deliberately reshape society to that end. This was, in essence, a war, in that a few leaders would dictate the sacrifice of the lives of many who were unwitting or unwilling in the name of national success. This historical example allows us to read between the lines of the official policy debate on the U.S. occupation of Iraq between the Bush administration, the incoming Congress, and the Iraq Study Group. It also illuminates the meaning of the response of the political and media establishment toward the work of Dr. Les Roberts, our featured speaker this week. The politics are being framed as a contest between bipartisan so-called pragmatists of the study group versus administration national security hardliners. In fact, both of these groups represent industries with some type of present or hoped-for economic interest in Iraq. Not evident in either group is any sense of shame or contrition, which would be appropriate in light of the facts that the invasion of Iraq for the purpose of gaining control of its resources and institutions through regime change was planned before the present administration was even installed and has nothing to do with terrorism, as the nation was told. That lies about the motives and justification for the invasion, such as WMD, were put forward to gain public and international support for a project whose real objectives were known only in the circles of the powerful, and that the resulting invasion has led to the deaths and mutilation of hundreds of thousands of people, including Americans, as well as destroyed Iraqi society. In light of this, the tone of the Iraq Study Group seems grotesque to me, including as it does ultimatums in the form of benchmarks of performance for the putative Iraqi government, and their insistence that U.S. troop withdrawal is in some way contingent on the satisfactory disposition of the oil resources. Thus, the media discourse that portrays the administration and the study group as conflicting is just political theater, as the study group has merely repackaged the original and still unofficially acknowledged objectives of the invasion: the control of the future of Iraq and its resources by an Anglo-American state corporate alliance. Furthermore, I submit to you that the people in the media managing the official discourse know, and did know, and don't care, that the weapons of mass destruction claims were just propaganda for the public. Otherwise, why is the discussion of casualties so thoroughly dismissed and downplayed by them, as well as the government, instead of, for example, acknowledging the carnage, as was done in their coverage of Hurricane Katrina? After all, if the Iraqis were not planning to attack America with WMDs, and a mistaken belief on that score led to the slaying of hundreds of thousands and the leveling of their cities, isn't that just the slightest bit horrifying? Even if one considers the invasion to be a so-called mistake rather than a deliberate atrocity, a mistake that led to such calamity would, at least in the life of an even moderately ethical person, initiate acts of contrition and reparation. If your memory is long enough, contrast this with the government's approach to casualty reports during the Vietnam War, where large numbers of enemy dead were proclaimed as success. The present presidential definition of success does not include large Iraqi body counts, but at the same time fails to be clear about just what success does include, since that would point to the still unacknowledged pecuniary motives of the invasion and undermine the war on terror rhetoric that has been chosen to forward further imperial objectives. These are the thoughts that occurred to me anyway when I recorded a recent community dialogue with Dr. Les Roberts held in Trumansburg, New York. Roberts is the author of two studies of mortality in Iraq, conducted in 2004 and this year, which were published in the UK medical journal, The Lancet. Though Roberts' research takes him all over the world, he was raised in the Syracuse area and now makes his home in Chenango County, which is part of New York's 24th congressional district that includes, for WEOS listeners, most of Tompkins, all of Seneca, and parts of Ontario and Cayuga counties. Roberts made an abortive run in the Democratic congressional primary this year, and he addresses the politics of politics as well as the politics of science and of the media. He spoke at the November 17th meeting of Back to Democracy, a community group based in Trumansburg. Allen, one of the organizers, introduces the speaker.
Tonight, we're honored to welcome Les Roberts back to Trumansburg. Les has worked for the Center for Disease Control after he got his PhD from Johns Hopkins. And now he is a lecturer and researcher at Johns Hopkins, and he's also accepted a teaching position at Columbia. Les is an epidemiologist. I looked it up. An epidemiologist studies the incidence, distribution, and possibly the control of diseases which affect health, and diseases and other factors that affect health. And the main factor affecting health in Iraq is violence that can be directly attributed to George Bush and indirectly attributed to the American people who elected him and fund his wars. In August and September of 2004, Les risked his life by traveling to Iraq to collect data for a study on Iraqi mortality pre-invasion versus post-invasion. More recently, he arranged for the collection of data to do an update to that study, and that updated study was published by The Lancet on October 11th of this year. Imagine if in our lifetime we could reach a point where it wouldn't be necessary to send epidemiologists all over the world to study the effects of American imperialism. I brought this chart. Can everybody see my chart? There's a big bar and a little bar. And the big bar represents 770 violent deaths per 100,000 per year in Iraq. And the smaller bar represents 34 violent deaths per 100,000 per year in Washington. I brought this so that, to illustrate how important it is for us to have the study, the Johns Hopkins study, because this larger bar, the data is derived from the Johns Hopkins study. The smaller bar, the deaths in Washington, D.C., is derived from FBI data. And the reason I bring this up is because there is a recently reelected Republican representative congressman from Iowa. And he was quoted on the House floor saying, quote, "My wife lives with me here, and I can tell you, Mr. Speaker, she's at far greater risk being a civilian in Washington, D.C., than an average civilian in Iraq." This guy gets a lot of press. This is from Newsmax. Quote, Despite media coverage purporting to show that escalating violence in Iraq has the country spiraling out of control, civilian death statistics compiled by Representative Steve King indicate that Iraq actually has a lower civilian violent death rate than Washington, D.C. Using Pentagon statistics cross-checked with independent research, King said that he came up with an annualized Iraqi civilian death rate of 27 per 100,000. He's right that living in Washington, D.C. is dangerous. Washington and Detroit and New Orleans are the most dangerous cities in the United States. You'd be right to be nervous walking alone after dark in on the streets of Washington, D.C., but you'd have to be insane to do it in Baghdad. A tsunami washed over the country on November 7th, a week and a half ago. It's too bad that Les wasn't quite able to ride that wave into Washington. Better luck next time. Please welcome Dr. Les Roberts.
Hi, guys. Nice to see so many old acquaintances. I actually want to talk for a little while, not so much about our study, I'll talk about that a little bit, but more about the media reception of the study in 2004 versus the study 6 or 7 weeks ago. When our study came out in 2004 that Alan just mentioned, stating by that time we thought 100,000 civilians had died, it was downright bizarre how it was on the front page of every European newspaper, every Middle Eastern newspaper, every Asian newspaper, and it made something like page B12 of the New York Times, and it was in the Washington Post on page, I don't know, 16. In the Washington Post, they actually interviewed us, and they said, oh, this study's bound to be controversial. And then they interviewed a guy from Human Rights Watch, a weapons analyst, and said, what do you think of this study from Johns Hopkins saying 100,000 civilians have died? And he said, you know, I don't know. I haven't seen the study, but 100,000 seems way too high to me. They quoted him as saying, 100,000 sounds way too high to me. And because he was the first sort of liberal to discredit our study, he was on CNN, he was on NBC, and none of the authors were, or he was on NPR, none of the authors were asked to be on. It was bizarre. It was just bizarre. And he got to his office, he got a hold of the paper, he started talking to his colleagues, and he realized that probably he had misspoken, and he never said it again. Brooke Gladstone on the media had him on, and on a portion on the radio of the interview that didn't get played, she was just prodding him to say, you know, admit it, this is wrong. You think this is wrong, don't you? And he wouldn't say that again. And he thought it was just bizarre. Turns out Brooke Gladstone's husband wrote a spin piece in Slate magazine talking about how imprecise this study was, and he was being quite widely attacked for that, and she was clearly trying to support her husband behind the scenes. I contrast this with this recent study that came out a little while ago, and we repeated the study last summer in June and July. The guys who I had trained and done the survey with the first time, they didn't need me. In fact, they said, you know, if any of you guys come back, it just puts us at risk. We know how to do it. Give us some cash. We'll make it happen. And so we did. And it was run by a great scholar. He's dean of the best medical school in Iraq. He was dean of the best medical school. He's actually gone hiding, and hasn't been home in many weeks out of concern for the interior police. And we repeated it, and by that time, 650,000, we believe, have died above the rate that they died in the last year of Saddam's reign. And this time, the study was handled a little more wisely by us. The first time around, all I thought about was, in 2004, getting this out before the election so that my Iraqi colleagues wouldn't have done a study in August and September that didn't come out till late November, and have everyone in Iraq think that they had made a cover-up for the Americans so that it wouldn't come out till after the election. That was all I was focused on. So I didn't share it with anyone. We didn't let anyone in the press know it was coming. It just came out through the Lancet. No one knew it was coming, and it was received with a lot of skepticism, in part because Dan Rather, just a couple weeks before, had gotten in hot water for saying that George Bush had gone AWOL, based probably on a forged document. So people were a little cautious about stuff like this just before an election. This time around, We handed it out to several members of the press in advance so that they could check the sources, talk to experts before it came out. I gave a couple talks at conferences so that a lot of the scientific community had seen the data and was able to grill me. Now, why do you think this? And I'd be able to give them technical answers back. We emailed it to maybe the 20 most famous people that do this sort of work, war epidemiology, in the world, so that if any news shows called them up, they would be able to talk about it intelligently. And it worked really, really well. It came out a little earlier than expected. The Wall Street Journal, let me back up. Medical journals often have this embargo, and they say, hey, newspaper, we'll let you see this, but you can't print it until Thursday. The Wall Street Journal decided, you know, how often do we care about what comes out in The Lancet? I mean, The Lancet is a medical journal. We don't care about them. So if we print it today before the New York Times and everyone else, then we'll have the scoop and we'll get all the blog hits and we'll be famous and our circulation will go up and it will be good for money and da-da-da. So a day before the embargo was to end, the Wall Street Journal sprung the story. They print before the New York Times. So the New York Times scrambled, and that day they let the story go out. CNN put it on their website. And so all of these groups, sort of in a cascading manner, broke the embargo. That wasn't a big deal. But all of those pieces were quite neutral. They had had time to go ask a few experts. And there's a tendency in the press now to do what the Congress does, to say, I want to have a scientific debate. So they find someone who's in support of it, and they find someone who's against it, and they have them both give their opinions, and they write it down. It might be that it's something like global warming, and the person in favor of saying the globe is warming is the head of the National Academy of Sciences, and he says every study ever done shows, and the person against might be an employee of the oil industry, and there might not be anyone else who thinks that way, but there's this tendency to want to give balanced stories. But nonetheless, all of those first stories were very fair. And for about a four-hour window, it was the only thing talked about on all of the news programs and on all the talk radio. And then an airplane hit a building in Manhattan. And the story was gone. That was it. That was the life cycle of the story. But unlike the first time around, now, when you read an article, especially in a magazine that was written slowly with a lot of thought, they'll give a range of how many people might have died in Iraq. And the range is suddenly a lot higher than it ever was before. The first study didn't sort of enter into the public, the press psyche in this country. There was this number that was out there before, 15,000, based on how many deaths had been recorded in newspaper reports. There was our number, 100,000. And the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and Daniel Shore always cited that 15,000 because it was safer and because the Pentagon said that's a reasonable number and the president had cited that number as the most likely number. That has stopped, I think. And it doesn't bother me so much that people aren't convinced that this is the right number because it's not the right number. It's a crude estimate and we're only 95% sure it's between 400,000 and 950,000. It's somewhere up there. But now, I think in the public's imagination, the range was, until a couple weeks ago, from maybe 50,000 to 650,000. That's what people were thinking was possible, which is great, because when they hear bad news, suddenly they're capable of hearing it with a little more negative and broad-minded lens than they had before. That's great. But then, the week after our study came out, the Minister of Health said, this Lancet study, no, this cannot be true. No, it can't be 650,000. I think probably it's more 150,000. So he suddenly tripled his number from the week before. And, you know, a couple people have pointed out in the press that if he can suddenly triple his number, and if he can be saying a number three times higher than the Brookings Institute and Iraqi body count and the president, well, maybe none of them really know. And maybe this scientific sample of 2,000 households picked at random might be a little more credible. I'm struck that in the last election and in the reception of these two articles, that public opinion has led foreign policy, not the other way around, I think. It's my perception that the American public is just fed up with the war in Iraq. And so now, when Slate magazine writes a negative critique of our study, unlike the last time, when I write a retort, they're going to print it. So actually, they accepted it today. And the Wall Street Journal did the same, and the Science magazine, who wrote a shocking article, with just a ton of made-up things, they're going to print our response. We tried this the first time around, and they didn't accept our responses. So within the media, the willingness to have debate, the willingness to accept the possibility that maybe 2.5% of the country has died has sort of expanded. And this is just all good. It's all good. I suppose on some level, I think it's just a little bit obscene for our president to be downplaying by a factor of 10 how many people have died. And my guess is that if Hugo Chavez said, you know, I think in the 9/11 attacks, maybe more or less 200 people died, I think there'd be a lot of people sort of ticked off. And essentially, when George Bush said a few months ago, well, I think more or less 30,000 have died, and when in a press conference a couple weeks ago he said, no, I don't believe it, it's much, much lower, maybe 40, 50, he's doing the same thing for everyone in the Middle East. He's certainly fanning the flames, and it's quite ironic to be upset with the president of Iran for saying that the Holocaust probably was only a tenth as big as people really claim, and to have our president essentially doing just the opposite thing in a smaller scale crisis, but nonetheless, in terms of fanning international anger, it is an unfortunate thing that we're not showing any contrition. So that makes me sad, but nonetheless, the incredible change in the press, right-wing talk shows calling me up and wanting to interview, is so different than just 2 years ago. 2 years ago, I probably got 50 threatening emails when this happened. I got a few nasty, you pseudoscientists, you're a joke, a few of those, but no threats this time around. And it's all for the good. And now let's move to the more interesting portion. I'm here to talk about whatever you want to talk about. Having been to Iraq, having visited a couple hundred houses, maybe I have a unique perspective compared to some, but I'm happy to talk about whatever you'd like to discuss.
Please. Before you leave that subject behind, could you say a little about why you think that is, why you think that change has happened?
Because the American public has become appalled with the war in Iraq. So suddenly writing things that sound appalling about the war in Iraq is acceptable and isn't seen as being attacking and negative of our troops. I have this friend, his name is Carl Vick. He's the writer for the Washington Post. He was stationed in Iraq about the first 18 months of the occupation. And while he was there, he told me in an email, you know, all the time I go into hospitals and they're full of people shot up by high-strung American kids who shot these cars up when they came up to checkpoints too quickly. I think that was a bigger problem in 2004 than it is today. And he said, I can't ever get my editors to run stories about that. Because they say, you know, that's just not the fight we want to pick right now, and it's going to piss off all our readers to hear bad things about our troops when they're feeling nothing but guilt and love for them. And, you know, the public becoming dismayed can trump concerns on that sort of lower level, I think.
Yeah, Les, when the study came out, I remember people saying, oh, we're surprised it's so many people. I was surprised it was so few. Because I'm remembering all of the people that died during the sanctions, not from bombs, but from starvation, contaminated water, no medicine. That situation has got to be worse when there's constant bombardment and shooting and chaos. So how does that figure into the study?
Much to my surprise, in both studies, the Iraqi people have proven to be extremely resilient. I've worked in 8 hot war zones and a few other places like Afghanistan after wars, and I don't think I've ever seen a place where social fabric is so strong. Engineers, doctors, nurses are all really well trained compared to Asian and African countries where I've worked, and everyone knows how to get those technical resources that are in their community. Even if your hospital is shut down, people know how to get a hold of the doctor if they really have an emergency. So there actually hasn't been that much rise, and I'm surprised. I'll just leave it at that. I'm surprised. Why don't I take the person in the back, and then I'll come up here.
I was just going to suggest you might give us a brief summary of how the study was conducted.
Sure.
Just so people who weren't here before, and
sure,
we have an idea of the credibility and, you know, how this thing got actually.
There's a problem in a lot of developing countries in that there's no functioning birth registration and death registration system. So it turns out for about half the countries of the world, the way we know how many people die is to try to pick clumps at random and go out and interview 30 households or 50 households. And it turns out that if you went to, let's say, 30 households in 30 locations across America and asked how many children have been born and how many people have died, and then someone else went to 900 individually randomly picked places, the people that went to 900 places would only have about twice the statistical power of the people that went to 30 places with 30 houses each. That is, the clumping of people reduces your strength of knowing things, but not by a lot. So what we did was we first assigned clusters so that if we had something like Tompkins County and Trumansburg is a 20th as big as Ithaca, we would pick some random numbers such that the chance of coming to Trumansburg would be a 20th as big as the chance of going to Ithaca. And then once we got to Trumansburg, we would, in a town this small actually, just count all the houses and pick one at random, visit that house, and when we got there, we'd say, who lived here on the 1st of January 2002? Who lives here today? And so they'd write, you know, male, 2 years old, female, 4 years old, and we'd write it all down, the gender and age of everyone. And then we'd say, has anyone moved in or out for more than 3 months in that window of time? Has anyone been born? Has anyone died? And when they give all the births and deaths and people moving away, we can look and see, do the people who were here in 2002 add up to the people that are here now if I think about the births and deaths and people moving? And then we can look at the deaths in that family before the invasion, March 19th, 2003, the deaths in that family after the invasion, and in essence, we can measure the death rate for that family before versus after. And then this family, and then this family, and this family. Turns out most families don't have any deaths. But when you repeat this process 2,000 times, you come up with a statistically meaningful sample. So we had a death rate before the invasion and a death rate after the invasion. And that increase we're attributing to the disruption that you mentioned associated with war. It happens, virtually all that increase in Iraq is from violent deaths. Before the invasion, about 2% of deaths were from violence. After the invasion, the vast majority of deaths are from violence. So that increase is almost all from violence. And this is called cluster sample, is the way we measure mortality in most developing countries. It's the way the U.S. government did it in Kosovo at the end of the war. It's the way the U.S. government did it in Somalia, the data that inspired the first President Bush, the real President Bush, to go into Somalia. It's the way we measured recently the death rate in Afghanistan, the way the U.S. government did it. So there's nothing controversial about this. And it is fascinating to see these people coming out of the woodwork to say this is invalid. There was an article written in the Wall Street Journal, not the original one. The original one was quite neutral. About a week later, there was an op-ed written. This guy called me up. His name was Stephen Moore. He said, I'm writing an article just to put this Lancet study in perspective for the Wall Street Journal. And so we talked for 40 minutes, and I talked about the lack of need to go to many more than 50 places, and actually it might be unethical to do so because you put your workers at risk for not much more statistical strength, and I talked about our distribution being normal, meaning that we can't really have a skewed picture, because if only going to 50 places missed something important, It can only be something really high, meaning our estimate would have to be too low. So nonetheless, we have this 40-minute conversation, and he picked out two or three sentences that I said that sounded the worst, that I hadn't seen the census from 1987, I haven't seen a 10-year-old census, and he wrote this scathing thing mocking us, essentially for not collecting any demographic data, which just isn't true, he just made that up. And he happens to have been Paul Bremer's pollster in Iraq. By the way, he's working for Paul Bremer right now in California. And it was just stunning. And it's really disturbing to me how all the comments and criticisms about the study so far have been like this nitpicking stuff. Well, 50 places might not be enough. And it's not about, wow, you know, even if this study is really badly skewed, even if it's got a bias of 20% up or down, this is really bad. We should be saying, I'm sorry, Iraq. And there's just none of that. So there was a question here.
That was my question, that this is the method that the United States has used in many, many different places. And now
the U.S. government funds a training program to get UN employees and NGO workers to employ this exact method to measure mortality in natural crises and wars.
And then Bush was asked about your study a few days after, and he said, oh, I don't think that's credible.
Right. He said the methods have been shown to be incredible. Actually,
he hadn't examined it yet.
No, of course not.
It's really interesting.
There are few things that can raise one's capital among your scientific peers than to have the president say you're not credible. A great gift for my career.
Does Paul Bremer have a pollster? What? You said this guy was a pollster for Paul Bremer. Well, why does he have someone?
Well, while he was...
Is he running for something?
No, while he was there,
yeah,
in Iraq, he wanted to be able to test how messages would work among the public, okay, and essentially do propaganda.
Yeah.
And why he's working for a consulting firm headed by Paul Bremer now, I can't answer.
Oh, okay.
They must have gotten along okay.
Yeah, I guess.
Yes, please, sir.
When you deal with the ladies and gentlemen of the press, do the two magic words peer-reviewed have any magic, or is that only in certain circles?
No understanding of that at all. And the notion that maybe the chairman of biostatistics at the London School of Hygiene was one of the critiquers, and he didn't think 50 places was too few, that has never come up. There's a group in England, Iraqi Body Count, who's been monitoring events in the press. And their number is less than a tenth of our number. It's the number the president likes to cite on those rare occasions when he cites any number. We know this. In Tompkins County, if we called through the press or even the police reports to get an estimate of the number of rapes that occurred, let's say, over the last 5 years, we'd come up with a number. But if we went out and did a sample of women and could get them in a comfortable place with someone they trusted and that was confidential, we would come up with another number that would probably be many, many times higher. And this is always the case. We've searched and searched and searched and can't find anywhere where half of deaths were recorded in a time of war. The best we can find is Bosnia, where 30 to 40% of the deaths were captured by the government and press while the war was going on. And most of the time, it's 5% or 7% or 10%. So this is natural for us. But when our first study came out, Iraqi Body Count's funding just dried up. And they were really upset. And now that our study is bigger and can't be critiqued for being too imprecise, they clearly are very threatened. And most of the criticisms in the European press and the scientific literature are coming from two or three people that are good buddies with the guy that runs Iraqi Body Count and are desperate to discredit our study so their friend's project doesn't fall apart. What a funny little world. And back to the peer review issue, I keep talking to these journalists from Science Magazine and from whoever, and I say, there are a couple of hundred epidemiologists and public health workers that have done this kind of work. Why don't you go talk to one of them? And they'll come back, and they've talked to some psychiatrist at King's College who thinks you can't possibly do 40 interviews in a day, and this is impossible. They must have made up the data. There's another hand, please.
Actually, I have three kind of related questions. The first one is, approximately what is the population of Iraq?
About 27 million today, we think, but the problem, Estimates are 1 million people have fled. Estimates are 1 million people have moved around inside. That's crude. Could be as low as 25 million.
So 650,000 is a significant population.
2.5%. 1 in 40 people.
This study versus your first study is like 4 times worse. Is that because of things have gotten worse or just more time has passed?
As a rate, things have gotten a lot worse. A lot worse. And there is some ancillary evidence in support of this. If you look at the Brookings Institution's records of how many times our troops get shot at, they're now shot at every 15 minutes. There is an attack on our troops, whereas in 2004 it would have been a couple of events per day. So there's other evidence to that effect.
When you were here last year, you said we should get the hell out of there right now. Do you still feel that way?
I don't think I said it quite that way.
You said we were making things worse by being there.
I said, I believe the John Murtha line that we are fundamentally the fuel on the fire. I believe that. I don't think we should get out tomorrow, but I think we should publicly state this is not working. We need to get out. We should have a really aggressive timetable. I think that the generals on the ground should have some say. We should be aiming for 6 months and be willing to give people some latitude in case 12 months is needed. But it needs to be a heck of a lot more aggressive than all but a few Democrats are talking about now, I believe. Before I go back there, let me go to some people who haven't spoken. Hi.
Hey, how are you doing? Can we talk about, getting out is a way of dividing the country up in 3 sects, a possible thing that a lot of people are talking about today?
So now we're starting to get into judgment calls where I think the truth is nobody knows what's the right thing.
Yeah.
There are two terrible dilemmas for President Bush. What was that Clash song? Should I stay or should I go? If I stay, there will be trouble. If I go, it will be double. The most effective way to keep Iraq together as a nation would be for us to hightail it out there looking like we lost badly. That would create national unity. That would create a sense of pride and self-purpose. That would be the most important thing we could do to keep Iraq together.
Can they live together?
They could have 2 years ago. They could have before the Golden Mosque was bombed, I think. On the other hand, the more we appear to lose, the more likely we'll have a war in the region involving Iran and possibly Turkey in the years to come. And if we're not there fighting, the Europeans are going to be. So I mean, there's this terrible trade-off of do we want to seem strong and pretend we're still a force for some limitations on activity in the region, or do we really want that country to stay together in as prideful and peaceful a way as possible? So
a lot of people say it's impossible to keep the country together anymore.
But I think that that's not our choice. I think in the end that can only be determined by Iraqis, and I don't even want to have an opinion on that. I wouldn't want Iraqis having an opinion as to whether or not we should secede from the nation as New York State. I mean, that's not their business.
We have to get out.
We have to get out. We have to get out. I think there is great room for people of good hearts and open minds to debate, should we get out, leaving a protective force in Kurdistan, an area that's essentially almost autonomous at the moment, that's extremely pleased with us, that an area that has had extremely little violence, and use that as a tool to force the Shia and Sunni in the south to try to keep the country together because the Kurdish north has a lot of the oil, and thus trying to have a stable enough government to make them feel welcome would have some appeal, versus just leaving either in a John Murtha, move to other countries, or move all out Eugene McCarthy type approach. I'm not smart enough to sort of make a choice between those, and I'd rather we set it up so we're going out in a really clear timeline and the Iraqis are forced to make those choices for themselves. Yeah, in the hat?
Fallujah was one of the places that your study went in 2004, and I assume this time also.
That's right.
And it's had a very special role in the war right from the beginning,
right,
from literally the first weeks and months.
That's right.
And I wonder from your experience if you could just give broadly your reaction to what the effect of the war has been on illusion.
So in the first study, we only went to 33 randomly picked places. We had a list of the entire country by governorate. We assigned the clusters of governorates. For most of the governorates, we had then broken it down, the population, by essentially county, or most counties are just a city. And so we knew right in the beginning that we had randomly picked to go to Fallujah. And we saved it for last. I've done about 35 mortality surveys in war zones since 1990. And when you do this sort of study, and you know somewhere is the most dangerous place, you always save it for last. You save it for last for a couple of reasons. Your interviewers will be a lot more skilled and savvy by that time. And most importantly, if someone's going to get killed, if you're going to get killed, if your interviewer is going to get killed, heck of a lot better you're 90% done or 95% done. And, you know, this isn't a joke. And so that at least for your effort, there's this record of what you tried to achieve to show for it, rather than have someone get killed on day one and have nothing to show for what it is you're trying to document. So we saved it for last. And when it came time to go, I tried to talk this dean of the medical school, Riyad Lafta, out of going. And I said to him, Riyad, man, we have been to 32 of the other 32 places. Nothing has happened. Thanks be to Allah. Fallujah is getting shelled every day. It's surrounded by American troops right now. We have a terrible story to tell, and your going won't add anything to that story. And he said, no, I have to go. And I said, no, just think about the benefits. There's just not much to be gained from one more place. We already know mortality is up 60-ish%, almost all from violence. And he said, God has picked these random numbers, and I am doing God's work, and I must go. And just, we had this sort of, not heated debate, but we had this intense debate, and we just couldn't talk to each other about this, because this was all an issue of faith. And he went, and it was just a shocking experience for him. We went to 30 houses, but we also found something near 20 that had been abandoned, either because everyone there had died in shelling or people had left. So the city at that point had lost, from our one little grab, we would guess something in the order of 40% of its population. I was struck in the months that followed. Remember the day after the election, our troops went in and took Fallujah? And then about 6 months later, they were very proud of how they had stabilized it and the population had come back and it was great. And they said how they think that maybe 80% of the population of 200,000 is back in Fallujah now. Well, when I got the numbers of people in Fallujah in 2002, it was up over 300,000. And so the U.S. spokespeople had artificially just pretended the original population was a third less than it really was. So that makes me think a lot of people have gone. That's part one of your answer. Part two of your answer is, this time, because Fallujah was such an extreme outlier last time, when the guys went to Fallujah, this wasn't published in the paper, they actually went to two extra clusters just to see in that extreme place if the one they had picked by chance was typical across the city. And the three clusters were almost identical and had a much smaller death rate and a smaller fraction of people dead and missing. So it is strongly my perception that Fallujah has essentially been erased. A fraction of people, probably two-thirds, have come back. We will never know how many people died exactly. And our method now, going and knocking on a door of who's living there now, has almost no meaning when a third of the original families are gone. And those third are the ones that had the most mortality. That was a really long answer to your question. I think the city's been thumped. I think a third of the people are missing. I think we'll never know how many died. Yes, please.
I want to know if you feel as though you will have the opportunity to testify at any of the investigations that might take place.
That is a great question.
Back to the contrast between 2004 and 2006. 2004, study comes out. A couple months later, December, Dennis Kucinich's staff member calls me up and says, so do you guys really think this study is right? Do you think it's solid? That's great. Thanks. Congressman Kucinich just wanted to know before he quoted it if you still stood by it. End of conversation. A couple weeks ago, he calls me up and says, Congressman Kucinich wants you to come provide a briefing. So it's not a hearing. The Democrats don't control yet. They can't call hearings. But he wants you to come provide a briefing. It's now slated for December 10th. And we'd like you guys to present your study, and we'd like you to suggest someone who can talk about this study methodologically, and we'd like you to talk someone who can come and talk about the social impact of war and what 2.5% of the people dying means. This is a precursor for hearings in the new Congress. So, in answer to your question, just a lot of things changed two Tuesdays ago. A lot of things changed. Having a one-seat majority in Congress means the Democrats get to choose what hearings happen and not the Republicans. Everything's different. Yeah, in the back, please.
Based on some of the other comments about the way studies are done by the government, I hope that you'll have government people talk about the methodological process show that it's the same as yours.
That's tricky.
And second, it's incredibly depressing as you talk about what's next there. I'm very depressed that you don't have, and it's just because there isn't, that there's not much hope for a way to extricate ourselves and allow that region to be ruled again by its people peacefully. And that's incredibly disturbing. I was intending to ask you, what's your best hope? Where do you see the best plan for pulling us out to leave the region in a good state? And as you spoke, I didn't hear anything in there that could lead me to...
First of all, I don't want to give you hope because I think things are bad, and in the short term, things are going to be bad. And I don't want to pretend that I have something positive I can package for you in that regard. My friend Riyadh had an office next to someone who was a Christian. He had worked next to them for 20 years, and he never knew they were a Christian until the Americans invaded in 2003. He said, when the invasion happened, suddenly everyone started to pay attention to who was Shia, who was Sunni. He said, it was just never known. He said, I could have figured out that someone was a Shia or a Sunni because I would know what tribe they were from and what city they came from, and then I could sort of think it through. In the same way you and I might think, oh, that's an Irish name, I'll bet they are a Catholic background, or their name ends in Berg, I'll bet they're of a Jewish background. So it just wasn't there, and he said that not as the invasion happened, but as soon as that anarchy and looting started, and it went on for some weeks, and people started to get scared that society wasn't ever going to stabilize, people started only eating with their like at the cafeteria, and they stopped talking so comfortably without their other friends, and family became a lot more important than it had before. A friend of mine from Ireland said the ebb and flow of war in Ireland had the same effect in her mind there. I am very optimistic that if we leave, the fabric of being Iraqi is stronger than the fabric of being Shia or Sunni. I don't think it's stronger than the fabric of being Kurds. I think the Kurds are happy to not be part of a great... will be happy to be not be part of a great Iraq. Remember, they voted in the last election in a non-binding way, and something like 96% of the Kurdish population wanted to have a separate semi-autonomous state. So I am very hopeful if we leave, there's going to be a ton of violence. There's going to be a lot of ethnic partitioning within certain parts of Iraq, but that within months, the violence will be able to calm down and an Iraqi government will, to some extent, be able to run a country. I bet violence will go up for some months right after we leave. But over the course of a year, it probably will save lives for us to leave rather than die. So that's the best I can do. Let me go first to the gal in the white sweater, and then I'll come here, okay?
Oh, thank you. I think that was a great statement just now. I've spent a lot of time in Iraq and with my husband, and spend most of my time working with Iraqi people, and I'm on the phone daily with them. And I loved what you said about the society. It was, it's incredibly strong. I've never seen anything like it. And I think that's what saved them through all the years of sanctions and what is holding them together as much as they're together now. Mm-hmm. But right now, I mean, it's so bad right now. The daily terror and the breakdown in, I mean, we never talk about mental health of people. I mean, there's never been any mental health care there to begin with. And now the stress, almost everybody I'm talking to, even 14-year-old girls, their hair's falling out, they've got horrible stomach cramps and pains all the time, not to mention the standard dysentery and everything from the bad food and lack of electricity and clean water. And I agree with you that there's no hope if we stay in there militarily. I think that we need to take all our money and all our big reconstruction companies out of there.
I think we can slip out responsibly. We don't have to restrict this, but yeah.
I think it has to be quite quickly, and I think it has, militarily it has to be quite quickly, and I think we need to relinquish the policing duties to other neighboring friendly countries that are not the United States or its coalition partners, such as they are. I want to go back to the media part, and the fact that the media haven't given you very much credence, even with your incredible scientific credentials earlier, okay, the 2004 study, and with your credentials and your remarkable expertise and your partnerships and your peer reviews and so forth. So just imagining how little, or seeing how little interest is given to your work, or has been given historically up until now, underscores the fact that the humanitarian stories, the stories of people on the ground get practically no mention whatsoever. And we talk about statistics and numbers and policy and can we fix it by pulling out now? It's really, the Iraqi people are perfectly brilliant and capable and socially adept and educated, and they can take control of their own country. It's really not our place to be telling them what to do. And I don't know, there are many points that I want to make, but I guess that's the most important one, is the Iraqi people have forgotten in all this. And
thanks for that.
I have a question. I believe that before the invasion, there was a similar epidemiological study about excess deaths in Iraq.
No.
And
not
I
quite.
Wondered about what that was, similar, and how was it different.
So there were a couple over the window of time when the sanctions were going on. All of them just looked at deaths of children under 5. Unfortunately, the one that got the most notoriety was headed by a Pakistani woman who was at Harvard at the time. She trained a bunch of college students in Jordan, and they went in, and she said 500,000 children have died because of the sanctions. Yeah. A couple people were very skeptical about this, and someone went back and looked at the data. And there were, I think, about a dozen interviewers, and one interviewer accounted for most of the child deaths. And that put up a red flag. And so there was a demand at Harvard that the data be reviewed by the university. The data was reviewed. The committee said, you must print a retraction. It had been published in The Lancet also. Said, you must print a retraction. The gal didn't ever quite publish a retraction. She wrote this little letter saying, it is so difficult to study these things and great problems arise in precision, da 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 da. There were a couple of others, the best one probably being by UNICEF, that looked at a window of time. The last one, I think, was 1997. And said, well, if it's been like this, probably 250,000 children have died of sanctions. That was a similar study by a similar method. Cluster survey, interviewing households.
Similar
to the study we did. And it probably was reasonably well done. And, yeah. Did that answer your question?
You were saying that almost all your deaths were from violence.
That's right.
And since this study was before the act of fighting, it was practically all
This illness. All children with diarrhea and not getting enough food.
And some injuries.
The effects of sanctions on water supply. Yeah. Yes, please.
You mentioned hearing from Kucinich. But there have been many members of Congress who have even more stature than Kucinich has. And over this period of time, have there been any members of Congress at all who have taken up your view and gone with it anywhere? If so, I haven't seen it heard. Even in the campaign, it was hardly mentioned.
That's right.
July, huh?
That's right. I have heard no political figure on the Democratic side cite our work. That's correct. The first time around...
Have you tried with that one?
The first time around, I sort of looked at the players and thought, who is most likely to take this up and infuse it into a hearing so I would get to speak? And I decided that it was Patrick Leahy. And I went and met with his staff, and they said, you know, we know about your study. We know it's true. We have lots of other ancillary sources telling us it's true, but we don't control anything. And, you know, you need, if you come to us with a really narrow proposal, like money to up surveillance in Iraq, we can probably get that worked in, but we can't have anything to openly discuss this issue. So that's where we were in 2004. I think everything's in flux. People haven't had time to think about their 2007 agenda, but it's coming. It's coming, I promise you. Actually, can I go to a related question that I never answered for you in the Beck and Green? I hope you said, I hope you can get the government scientists to come and verify this. The best person in the world at this process of measuring deaths in times of war is at the Centers for Disease Control. And after the first survey, a lot of reporters called up the CDC and said, you are our National Institute of Epidemiology. Is there someone there that can talk about this Lancet study claiming 100,000 deaths? The press office, which when I was there years ago, were these people who thought their job was to get anyone on the outside that was interested in any of the boring science that happened on the inside to get them together. I mean, these CDC people are folks who spend their whole lives trying to eradicate guinea worming. These are people so boring, their families don't even talk to them when they go home for Thanksgiving. These are really quirky scientists. And so everything the press office did was about getting information out. When that call came to the CDC press office, now run by Homeland Security, said, nope, no one here who can talk about that. But there is a statistician from Harvard. So they gave him the guy's number. He actually wasn't at Harvard. He was at the American Enterprise Institute. And he was a signatory on the Project for the New American Century. And that happened within hours of the first Lancet study coming over the wire service. I mean, they are so good at controlling the message compared to the CDC I knew just 15 years ago. And if that best person in the world methodologically came and spoke in front of Congress, he's got 19 years in, he's due for retirement next year, he has a newborn child, the chances of him never getting his pension are really, really high. I wouldn't try to get him to talk. The things that happen to scientists within NASA about global warming, within the CDC about a couple of hot topics, I think are just a huge threat to their well-being. And so I don't agree. I think that if we get government scientists to speak, we can't get people at this moment in history who will come forward and speak honestly. We're going to get dupes of the administration who are going to say, this is crazy because they didn't wear pink carnations when they knocked on the doors or whatever.
You're listening to a community forum with Dr. Les Roberts. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KWMD Kosilov Anchorage, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren.